From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Welcome to the program. You know, countless good-hearted people feel more and more overwhelmed, exhausted, and discouraged. And in the rush and hurry of our busy lives, we rarely pause to listen carefully, to listen for those still, small voices that call our hearts to evolve, to change, and be changed. I got to tell you, there's a book out that I love, which is why I've invited the guests to come on today in the program. The book is called The Art of Stopping, How to Be Still When You Have to Keep Going. It's written by David Kuntz, and it's a guidebook, if you will, on how to navigate the crazy busy lives we lead. We are always on the go, it seems like. Balancing work, balancing family, friends, everything in between is a routine of running and never stopping, a cycle, oh God, that can be tiring, even just sharing this with you. We forget the beauty of the smaller moments, and sometimes we even forget ourselves, and life has gotten so complex that our old methods of coping, cramming and excluding, well, they just no longer work. David's here to share another way. The author, David Kuntz, has enjoyed several careers, actually, including 19 years as a Catholic priest, 20 years in the practice of psychotherapy, and over 2 decades teaching courses on managing stress and emotional health and writing. He has a graduate degree in psychology and theology and a doctorate in pastoral psychology. He's authored numerous books, and he's joining us from beautiful Oakland, California. David Kuntz, welcome to the program today.
Richard, thank you. Delighted to be with you.
This book spoke to my heart because I have long believed we have insane, crazy, busy lifestyles, and it's creating way too much stress in people's lives. I find that the older I get and the more years I work as a hospice chaplain, I begin to see what really is important. And oftentimes it's not the kind of lifestyle that we've had. And so even the title of this book, when Eileen sent it to me, The Art of Stopping, I said, yes, I don't even need to see the book. I know it's going to be good. So thank you for this gift that you've given all of us.
Well, you're more than welcome. It's been a delightful experience for me as well.
Can you tell me, first of all, why you wrote a book such as this? You've written quite a few books in your life.
Yes. Well, Richard, you know, this was really extremely personal. I was, earlier in my life, I was a clergyman. And to make a long story short, had a really severe midlife crisis, you might say. And I didn't know what to do. I was a relatively happy and content and fulfilled Catholic priest. And the bottom sort of fell out. I didn't find meaning in what I was doing, which I had done excessively in the past, but it just left me. So anyway, what I did was I did it because I didn't know what else to do. I went away. I rented a small cabin on the north coast of California. And I looked at the ocean for a month. I was fortunate to be able to do that. I got permission from my bishop to do that. And I went up there and I sat and I looked at the ocean and I didn't do anything because I didn't know what else to do.
And
when I came back to my life after the month, it wasn't any sudden realization of what I need to do with my life.
Yeah.
But it was a gradual understanding of the important things in my life, the values that I had, and what the way ahead looked for me became clear. And it was then that I began to formulate the whole concept of stopping.
You know, by doing that for a month, most people would bring retreat books and journals they would be doing while they're probably needing to stop. But as you said, because you didn't really know what else to do, it forced you to stop. And I can't imagine how wonderful, perhaps even challenging, that month was for you, but definitely life-changing.
Exactly, Richard. Yeah, it was both those things that you mentioned, wonderful and challenging. There were times that I sort of was saying, what the heck am I doing here? This is crazy. And at other times, I felt extremely peaceful and centered. And as I say, it was only after I came back to life into my normal life that I realized what the way ahead was for me.
Yeah. You know, right in the first chapter, you quote my all-time boyhood hero, and he's still my hero, and it's Abraham Lincoln, having been grown up in Springfield, Illinois when I was a little boy. The quote you chose, though, from Lincoln was, he said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." And then you shared another quote from somebody you were working in your counseling office, Mary Ellen, and she said, "It's too much, way too much. I just can't deal with it all." That hit me because I'm hearing people say that today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it couldn't be more timely because of the crazy, as you said, the crazy schedule that so many of us lead and can't escape from.
Yeah,
I think especially in this time of COVID, of the epidemic, my heart goes out to these young couples with two jobs, three kids, homeschooling. Oh, my goodness. I can't imagine what their life must be like. So my heart really goes out to so many people with crazy schedules that they have a huge challenge in changing.
Mm-hmm. And most people change in ways that doesn't really work for them. You talk about that also in your book, about cramming and cutting don't work, which is what we often do. Stopping, it really is radical in an age of busyness that we live in. And I think sometimes social media contributes to that. I was just talking to another friend last night who shared something that I think 60 Minutes did a cover on, and that is we often compare our lives to others. Mm. And if they're busy and traveling and going for it and going big, and we feel like we have to also, otherwise we feel like a failure.
Yes, that's so true. And yes, stopping is very countercultural. The culture that we live in the West, especially in the United States at this time, it does not reward or encourage stopping or doing nothing. It doesn't do that. In fact, it encourages the opposite, as you said. Go, 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 accomplish, do everything you can possibly do in the short amount of time, which is very, very contrary to stopping. Which maybe it's important at this point to define stopping. I define stopping as doing nothing as much as possible for a minute or a month, in order to wake up, remember who you are and what you want.
Oh, that's a beautiful definition.
That's the simple concept. And there's, you know, I like to keep it with no rules. Mm-hmm. There's a few guidelines, but there's no rules. That's why I call it the art of stopping, because you bring to it what is you and your style.
Now, how well were you doing that back in the day when you were a clergyman?
Not well at all.
Yeah.
No, I was a total failure at it. I was right along with the Rat Pack. I was running and doing too much and saying too much and talking too much and I mean, it was not a pretty picture at all when I had my crisis.
Exactly. Yeah. We love to do things for Jesus, don't we?
Or for
the sake of the church.
Yes, it's all for the good of the people.
Oh,
and the
of course.
And for God.
Of course.
What could be wrong with it?
Yeah, has nothing to do with our ego. My goodness, as a former minister myself. Uh-huh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a quotaholic probably, and so I loved your M. Scott Peck because that really spoke to what you're saying now. And he said, "I have a very full and busy life, and occasionally I'm asked, 'Scotty, how can you do all you do?' And the most telling reply I can give is, 'Because I spend at least 2 hours a day doing nothing.'" But that's what you're saying, whether it be a minute, whether it be a half hour, just to stop a little bit each day. And also probably just reflect, just be in that moment.
Exactly. That encapsulates stopping. That's the whole idea of it.
Why is it so hard? What has been your journey about? How's it taught you? And also in the years that you have been sharing with others, the truths that you have in this book, what are they telling you?
You know, I think we're all sort of in many ways alike on this, and that is for some reason in our culture and what we have been born into in the West, we carry a fundamental fear. And that fear, sometimes hard to define, sometimes very, very hard to acknowledge and look at, is a fear of that maybe some unidentified monster is going to jump out of our psyche and consume us, or the fear is going to be what will I do if I have nothing to do? Blaise Pascal said all of human beings' troubles stem from man's or people's inability to sit still in a room. So I like to challenge people. Imagine yourself, pick a room in your house or somewhere else where you will not be disturbed, where it's quiet, where there's nothing at all going on. Take a chair, put it in the room, sit in the chair for an hour. Do absolutely nothing. And most people look at you like you got six heads. They're going to say, why would I do that? And my answer is, because if you don't, you're going to forget too much. You're going to miss your inner wisdom. The whole basis upon which stopping is built is the assumption, or to me it is an assumption, it's a fundamental knowledge, and it's taught by all of the systems of spirituality, East and West, and that is that everyone has within them the knowledge and the wisdom that they need to live the life they want to live. It's all there. It's not something we're going to find outside of ourselves, somewhere down the road. It's within us. It's there. But with the culture that we live in and the distractions that we have, we don't hear that voice. We cover it up. We run ahead of it. We don't look at it because we're too busy, too noisy, too distracted. So my conviction is once you're quiet enough and still enough and alone enough, then that voice becomes accessible. Then you hear what you have always known in your inner reality. So stopping gives you, it's simply a way of accessing that wisdom, getting a pipeline to it so that you can really act on it.
Thinking what you were going through, as you shared earlier, in terms of the career you were in, which was an impetus for you to just stop for 30 days, I'm wondering, does it take often hitting bottom, so to speak, to finally get someone's attention?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, Richard. That so often maybe I'll start here. I divide stopping into three ways of doing it, and they're based on the amount of time that one spends doing it. There's still points, which are very quick, from a few seconds to a few minutes to a few hours. And there are stopovers, which are longer times, a day or two or three or more. And then there's what I call grinding halts, which is what I did, a long, long time of stopping. And as you indicated a moment ago, most people get to their grinding halts because they're stopped, either by an accident or by illness or by some unfortunate event, which puts them in a hospital or in some capacity. And that is a very, very bad way to do a still point, or very bad way to do stopping, because you're sick. And when you're sick, all you want to do is put your energy in getting better. So it's a very distracting state, illness, and it's not a good way to do stopping. Much better to choose it and to be still and to be quiet so that you can really, really get to your thoughts. So, yeah, it's that fear of, oh, what is our fundamental fear? Of being alone, of not finding meaning, of waking up some morning when we're too old, or at least we think we're too old, and realizing I missed it. I didn't live the life I wanted to. I didn't become the person I wanted to become. That's a very sad thing, isn't it?
It's very sad. And one of the things I've learned from Buddhism is their practice of death meditation, which I try to do a little bit each day in my own way, because it helps me to stop and reflect and remind that I don't have forever. to embrace Absolutely. My friend death, my own mortality, and that helps just a little bit to answer some of those questions you're talking about, where we wake up one day and said, man, what was my life all about?
Brilliant, Richard. Yes, that's if only we could get people to contemplate their death. And it sounds so morbid in our culture to say that.
Yeah.
Why would I want to think of death? Because it's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there for all of us, and who knows when. So yes, what a wonderful way to express it.
I want to talk a little bit more about the three ways of stopping, because that is a key piece to what you're teaching. But I'd like for you to share, because even the title of the chapter was so beautiful. I love poetic words. You said finding the spaces between the notes. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, I love that. That's I take directly from a poem by Rilke. And in the poem, he says, I am the silence, I am the stillness between two notes of music. Mm. And that the music only has meaning if you put the stops between the notes.
Yeah.
If you imagine music with no stops, it becomes what? A siren, a wail, a scream. But when you put those moments of stopping, of quiet between the notes, the melody, as the poet says, the melody goes on beautiful. So that's what I like to see us doing in our day. Put the stopping points, the still points in between the events of our lives.
Yeah.
From going to the grocery store, to picking up the kids, to dropping off the laundry, to whatever you do in your life, you have lots of in-betweens, lots of to-froms. Those are the moments that can give incredible meaning if you just do a still point, which is closing your eyes. No, first of all, stopping what you're doing, closing your eyes if you can safely do that, turning your energy in, and just being still. Or you can add a little prayer, or you can add an affirmation, or you can bring to mind someone you love. It doesn't really make any difference. As I said, no rules. Do it your way. Just turn your energy in and be still and remember. And if you do that 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day, I'll guarantee you come to the end of your day much more refreshed, much more integrated.
I had to get stopped. I'm thinking about the time I came down with amnesia on December 15th, 2010. And long story short, it was an incredibly busy year for me. I was still working full-time hospice chaplain with a patient overload. I was still maintaining a not-for-profit, and I had signed off on bringing a big-name speaker, and there was a fundraising behind that, still doing the radio show. And long story short, I'm getting ready to launch yet another movement. And it's like, what was I thinking? And ironically, what was I thinking? Come to find out, I wake up in a hospital room, and one of the people I had asked to be a board member of this nonprofit, which never then eventually happened, said, well, you ran the meeting, but your speech was getting a little faster, and you went into the bathroom, and he said, Richard, you came out, and your pupils were dilated, and you walk up to me and said, I don't know who I am or where I am.
Oh, my goodness.
He took me to the ER. They admitted me. And I was out for about 17 hours. And I had a couple of really cool experiences after that, that taught me what you're just talking about. But it took the divine, if you will, to take my brain, to take my thoughts in order for me to stop. And what you're saying is we don't have to go through those things. We don't always have to hit rock bottom if we're wise enough and careful enough and making the right choices.
Right. Yes. But what a story, Richard. I appreciate your sharing it. That really is an amazing experience and a great experience of stopping. Yes.
Yeah. 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 And so back to still points. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Then we'll go into the stopovers.
Okay, still points. Those are the short times, anytime, every time. I like to give an example of my own. Like, I used to give seminars to nurses on stress management, and I'm an introvert, basically. So those kinds of very externalized, extroverted activities like giving seminars are very stressful for me. They tire me a great deal. So what I tried to do when I did that is I peppered my presentation, my day-long presentation, sometimes 2 days, with still points. And the people I was presenting to had no idea that I was doing anything different than just presenting a seminar, because they were so brief. I would stop. I would maybe walk away from the podium for a few seconds, and I would turn my energy in, remember why I was doing this work, and then I was back. And I would do that regularly during the presentation, and it did. It gave me energy. It gave me purpose. It gave me the message that, yes, you can do this. You can do what you need to do and you love to do. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of a still point. I like to think of or encourage people, if they can, to go get away, if you can, briefly. Go to the copy room. Go to the bathroom. Go any place where you can be alone and do a still point. Just look at yourself in the mirror, or pour a little cold water on your wrists, or just a break. Turn your energy, and that's the important thing. Turn your energy in to your inner life. And some people, and when I've presented this in seminars, people say, "No, you keep talking about this inner life. What are you talking about?" And I'm convinced that everybody knows what their inner life is, but it's a hard thing to define, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's what makes you who you are. And one of the ways I like to look at it is, whatever the world sees you doing, in other words, your outer life, the inner life is in control. The inner life controls what the outer life looks like. And I think with that kind of a little metaphor, it makes it easier for people to say, okay, I get it now. Yeah, it's my thoughts, my desires.
Boy, it's those daily disciplines, isn't it? When you mentioned about just go to the copy room or even go to the restroom. And yet, invariably, what people will do, if they were to do that, they would also take their cell phone with them.
Exactly. Yes. And that's what we have to discipline ourselves not to do. Yeah. And I think it's going to be harder for younger people than it is for us who are older. Mm-hmm. Because they were born, some of these kids are born with a computer in their hand, so to speak, with a phone in their hand, with a screen in their hand. And this reminds me that with this pandemic, it must be a lot more difficult for younger people than it is for, I'm retired, and it's changed my life, but not that much, not as much as it has changed it for an 18-year-old. So I'm thinking, wow, my heart goes out to those kids.
Wow. Talk about the gift of breath and how powerful that is and everything you're talking about here.
Yeah, so powerful, so basic. The basic thing in a still point is a breath. Take a deep breath. Turn your energy in and be still. There it is. Yeah, and the breath brings, as you know, not only spiritually, but physiologically, brings oxygen to the system, to the brain, and it actually helps one relax. Deep breathing does. So, yes, breath, a diaphragmatic breath is basic to a still point.
Well, then there's the stopovers. And that's taking it a step further, isn't it?
Time-wise, it's taking it a step further. Mm-hmm. So I have in the book several examples of them. Imagine spending a whole day in a stopover, which is doing nothing as much as possible. I always add that because, I really wonder, is it really possible to do absolutely nothing? I don't know if it is, because that inner the monkey mind, as they say in Buddhism, that keeps running around. It keeps chattering. There's an internal chatter. So is it really possible to do nothing? Maybe and maybe not. I don't really worry about that too much. I say do nothing as much as it's possible for you to do nothing. Mm-hmm. One guy used to say to me, "My doing nothing is playing golf." And I thought, well, that wouldn't work for me. But if it works for him, great.
Yeah.
Remember, no rules.
Yeah.
Do what works for you.
You shared somewhere when asked about why do people have such a hard time stopping? Boy, I certainly agree with your answer. You said, in a word, fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really think it is. We're a fearful race. So many things that might happen or so many things that might not happen. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the pressures of society, the pressures of our peer groups and all those things that go on. We're a people in pain. Oh, Richard, the pain that goes on in the world, isn't it just overwhelming when you think of the pain? And well, you especially who work in the work that you do,
yeah,
must see this so much.
Well, and with our shadow side that often comes to haunt us late at night if we wake up. You know, I find that oftentimes if I wake up in the middle of the night, it's never something positive on my first thought. It's usually a fear or an anxiety.
Isn't that true?
Fear happens to be a shadow I've had or lack of confidence. And another teacher said once, and I've loved that phrase, he said, it's coming up not to be healed, but it's coming up to be held. And so you befriend that shadow.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you share more about that, especially in your life and in your journey?
Well, I talk in the book about the benefits of stopping, and one of the benefits is embracing the shadow. And yes, my shadow as a priest, you know, the image of a priest is very clear for most people, and to try to live up to that image is sort of it makes you deny so much of your humanity.
Yeah.
And so much of what is natural to the human being. So so I was very slow to embrace my shadow, kept it at a distance. And then, as you know, if you keep your shadow at a distance, it's going to come out one way or another, right? It's going to,
yes.
That shadow is going to have its way. It's like unexpressed feelings that we get buried, and they get buried alive.
Yeah.
And they'll come out. They'll come out in bad habits or in addictions or even in illnesses. So yeah, embrace that shadow. See what what is your dark side. That was, I think, Jung's great insight, is that the shadow is dark, but it's not always bad.
Yeah.
It in fact, if you embrace it, it can lead you to amazing things.
Oh, and talk about Carl Jung. Now you said that, it reminded me of a quote I came across a couple of days ago, and I saved it. So I guess for this very conversation with you, David. But he said, solitude is for me a fount of healing, which makes my life worth living. Talking is often a torment for me, and I need many days of silence to recover from the futility of words.
Oh, beautiful.
I know, right?
I'm going to look for that one.
Yeah.
That's so true. And doesn't our culture tell us the exact opposite?
Yeah.
That's the thing. We're constantly told by advertising, by just the standards and the values that the capitalistic industrialized society gives to us.
Mm-hmm.
Do more, say more, talk more. Jung was wonderful.
Yeah, I realized some time ago, but I had this insight even about myself, that I've been gifted with extrovert skills, but by nature, and even on the Myers-Briggs, I'm an introvert. That's why if I teach or speak or whatever, I will get drained. I will feel like used of the divine, but I'll get drained. And large groups. So for me, and I find the older I get, the more I'm craving nature and times of solitude and that quiet. And I think there's a lot of people that really do need that. And I love what you're teaching in this book about trying to find just simple little breaks throughout the day. You know, not everyone can take those 30 days, and that's not what this book is about. But by doing that, you are doing yourself a great service.
A great service, yeah. Yeah, just listen to that quote from Jung, because solitude will give you yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It will give you your wisdom.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so the great mystic poet Rumi says, the quieter you become, the more you're able to hear.
Oh, yes. Isn't that true? That's it. That's the core of stopping. Another saying I like is from Milan Kundera, the Czech novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, slowness is to remembering as speed is to forgetting.
Oh.
So the slower you go, the more you remember. The faster you go, the more you forget. Just imagine yourself walking down the street and you're trying to remember somebody's name and you say, what is that? And then you just automatically slow down or even stop. And then it comes to you, oh, that's it, and then you go on your way again. Yeah.
David, have you had opportunity to teach this to businesses or organizations over the years?
You know, only minimally. I haven't done a lot with businesses. Most of the clients that I worked with and groups that I spoke to were healthcare workers and religious workers.
Yeah. Well, those two groups, yes, they do need to hear this and be reminded of this for sure because of the stress they're under, and especially during this time of COVID that we've been going through.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
but I would like to do it to with business people. I think, you know, they need it as much or more than anyone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think so, too. Let's talk about the grinding halt. Kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, really. You know, and this is what I love. I love grinding halts. And, you know, and right now, and I'm retired. I can. My life is a grinding halt in a way. But for most people in our culture, they probably will not do a grinding halt in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. But many will. And as we said earlier, some of them will be forced to do it by illness or accident. That's not the prime way to do a grinding halt. That really doesn't work because you're just focusing on getting better. So if this is for you, then probably it's going to happen around some life transition, a marriage, a birth, a divorce, a moving home, changing jobs, or losing a job, whatever it might be. Generally, often, that is, a grinding halt happens at that point. And by that, I mean a long period of time, 2, 3, 4 weeks. Some people do, as I'm sure you know, what they call a silent retreat. Mm-hmm. Retreat houses throughout the country often offer silent, directed retreats where you go to a retreat house, pay a minimal fee, and you get a director and you do a grinding halt. Basically, it's a wonderful way to do it. Mm-hmm. But you know, most people can't get away that long.
Right.
Or I like to think if you really here's what I hope happens with people: if they start with still points, if they start with these little gems, these little moments of quietude and of turning in, then they will enjoy them so much that they'll want to do a stopover, that they'll want to do it. They'll say, you know, being still for a day and being by myself and in solitude, that sounds good, like it does to you, like it does to you and to many people. But to the people who don't, if they do still points, my hope is that it'll get them to do a stopover. Then if you do stopovers, then you're going to say, boy, what about doing this for 2 weeks? What about a silent retreat for a month? Mm-hmm. How could I possibly work that into my life?
Yeah.
And if you really want to do it, you probably can.
You know, yes, and I'm making a note to myself. I've always wanted to do a silent retreat at Gethsemane, Merton's home, down in Kentucky. And it's like a 6-month, 7-month waiting list to even get on that. But I keep putting it off, you know, because what happens is people will say, well, I only have so much PTO time, paid time off, and I want to use that vacation to travel and experience things. They think it's really either consciously or unconsciously a waste of time by going somewhere to do nothing.
Waste of time.
Yeah.
That's our cultural teaching. It's a waste of time. Why would you want to waste your time? Hmm. How did we get so wrong-headed about that?
You have a list. I'd like for you to cover some of these because I think it'll answer maybe some questions that listeners might have right now about the gifts that come from stopping. Can you go through a few of those?
Sure. I think I named 6, so I'll just list them and then talk a little bit.
Yeah.
The first gift is attention, and then relaxation, and then solitude, and then knowing your boundaries, and the one we've talked about already, embracing the shadow. And then lastly, knowing your purpose. So let's look at attention. To me, I've evolved to the point of that I equate the gift of attention with prayer. Mm-hmm. Prayer and attention to me are the same thing. And by that I mean, if you really give your full attention to something, to some moment, to God, to an idea, to a person, then you are contemplating. You rise immediately to a higher level, and that really becomes prayer. Attending to something completely is a wonderful, wonderful gift, especially if that something is a person. If you're fully attentive to someone.
Well, and by being attentive, because you cover this in that chapter, you also say, you know, it's difficult to categorize distractions because almost anything can become a distraction and almost anything can be made noble.
Right.
And it takes us off the path we need to be on.
It does. It does. Yeah, if we don't pay attention. Mm-hmm. And then relaxation. I'm convinced that many people in our culture have really very rarely enjoyed total relaxation. I mean, really being relaxed.
Yeah.
I think of people who care for the sick. I think of family members who have another family member who's chronically ill, or someone who is chronically ill themselves. These people, I think, have very little relaxation in their lives. So it's incumbent on all of us to help other people relax and be still and be quiet and be okay with that. And then solitude.
Getting back to relaxation, I wanted to ask you,
yeah,
David,
sure.
And also your experience, how important is it also to take time to do a lot of that in the energy of nature?
Oh, absolutely. Nature to me is key. If you can do any of your stopping experiences in the context of nature, all the better.
Mm.
Because it means that we're in our element. We're made of the same stuff. We're stardust together with the earth. And the more we get out into nature, even if it's the park down the street,
yeah,
to be among trees, to be among greenery, to be among on the beach or on the shore, wherever it is, doesn't make any difference. In the arms of nature, it enhances absolutely everything, and it certainly enhances stopping.
Yeah, yeah. So talk about the gift of solitude.
Solitude, boy, I think this is the toughest one for people, to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, that fear comes up. We're so used to being bolstered by signs in the world, presences of other people, that we're okay and that life is okay and that we're going to be okay, everything's going to be okay. And that is true. Everything is going to be okay. But we find it so hard to trust that. And when we let go of the presence of other people, that really comes up in spades. That idea is, okay, you are alone now. You don't have anything else around you. What does that feel like?
Mm-hmm.
And most of us answer, the first answer we come up with is, it feels terrible.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I've had many experiences of people who, even being I used to live in Idaho, and I took a friend who was visiting from New York City on a trip to a ghost town up in the mountains of Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And he became paralyzed. He literally could not get out of the car. He said, "What if something happens?"
Oh.
I said, "Well, what do you mean? Well, what if I get sick?" I mean, he was literally paralyzed, and I have never seen. So we had to drive immediately back to Boise.
Wow.
to go into the city so there's, I think there's a lot of people, maybe not that extreme,
mm-hmm.
but that are that afraid, mm-hmm. of being alone. So take it step at a time. Be alone with a walk around the block.
Yeah.
And then be alone with something a little bit further away or mm-hmm. With a little more risk,
mm-hmm.
and take it gradually.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, it'll reward you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the idea of boundaries,
mm-hmm.
where I begin and you end and I begin. And so many of our psychotherapy offices are dealing with the issues of boundaries. And it's a difficult one, and especially in families. So many families are bounded together so much, and so many families are the other way. They're experiencing an explosion rather than an implosion. So to know who you are and where people are in your life, yeah, that's the gift of boundaries.
Yeah, and I would think also in those target communities that you speak a lot in, healthcare and clergy, mm-hmm, it's hard to set boundaries also because we want to heal, we want to help.
Exactly, exactly. And it's all, you see, the thing that's difficult, as you indicate, it's motivated by goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's hard with people because they say, I'm doing this for the kids.
Yeah.
I'm doing this for God. I'm doing this for the parish. I'm doing this for other people. And in fact, they are. They're not lying. They're generous people. And that's what's hard to help generous people know that they have to take care of themselves. It's one of the hardest things to do because it doesn't feel like, you know, it doesn't feel right to them. It feels like they're selfish. And that's, you know, the farthest thing from the truth. If you make yourself available to other people, then you need to be whole yourself.
And so how important is it to also have a sense of a unique purpose in this world?
This is such a difficult thing. One of the stories I like to tell is from a psychologist, and he tells a story of Ella Fitzgerald. And Ella Fitzgerald, as a little girl, went to a talent show and came out on stage, and the MC said, Miss Ella Fitzgerald is going to dance for us. And Ella walks over to the MC and whispers in his ear, and he comes back and announces to the people, well, no, Miss Ella Fitzgerald is not going to dance. She's going to sing. And he gives that as an example of someone who knows their calling very young and very early.
Yes.
Most of us don't get that chance. And most of us, our calling isn't so much a specific vocation to be a lawyer, a doctor, or a judge, or whatever. Most of us have the calling to be a kind of person.
Yes.
What kind of person do you want to be? What kind of person are you? That's your purpose. And stopping is, I don't want to say it's the only way to really find your purpose, but it's certainly the most efficient way.
Well, and by knowing that purpose, then it helps you make decisions because you'll want to ideally make only the decisions where you can use your purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So if you're a helper, then that's the kind of person you need to be. And stopping will help you get there. I think of the story of the busy executive who's climbing the executive ladder, as they say.
Yeah.
And she's climbing and she's climbing and she's successful and she gets rewarded with money and higher salaries. And she gets to the top of the ladder only to realize that the ladder is leaning against the wrong wall.
Yeah.
That's the tragedy. That's when you, as you mentioned earlier, when you get old and you feel like you're too old to make any changes, and you say, oh, no, I missed it. I forgot. And then what happens when we forget what we really wanted, why we're doing what we're doing, why we started doing what we're doing, when we forget that, then what really is sad is we forget that we forgot. And so it really we have no access to it. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's inaccessible to us. So, and that's what stopping can help. Well, if you stop, if you're still enough, then you get access to those things again.
Well, and so many times I've heard stories from hospice patients who maybe they're even 50 or 60 and thought they were going to retire or thought they'd have a chance at another life, and here they are pronounced terminal. And they've realized that all these years they dedicated their life to work they hated. They sacrificed their passion for a paycheck, and now it's too late. Again, the reason why we need to stop so we can also reflect and hear, just hear our hearts, if anything else.
So true, so accurate, well said.
There's challenges along the way. You talk about some of those and also discoveries. Can you cover a few for our listeners?
Oh, the challenges are so so many, and I don't want to be glib here because I know there's a lot of people who have a very, very challenging life, And if they look at their life and they listen to what I'm saying and they say, how the heck you think I'm going to get time to do anything like that?
Right.
Do you know what, you know, and I don't want to be glib and be unsympathetic to that. I really don't, because I think there are many people who are in difficult situations. But I also believe that it's exactly those people who need stopping more than anyone. So what I encourage those kinds of people especially to do is to do still points, because anybody, no matter how busy you are, can do still points. You absolutely can, because yeah. People won't even know you're doing them. And then you'll get good at it, and then you'll expand them a little bit, and you'll find ways. You will find ways, no matter how busy you are, to spend a little bit longer time. If it gives you pleasure, and if it gives you reward, which I'm convinced it will.
Yeah. So that's the advice you would give somebody, getting back to the title of The Art of Stopping. If they were to say, man, how do I even start with something like that? You would start with the simple still points that we can do every day.
Absolutely. That's the entry into stopping. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And well, how about a few of the other discoveries or challenges?
The attitude of our culture, mm-hmm. the attitude of our families.
Mm-hmm.
I can just hear kids saying to their mother, "You're going away for 2 days. Who's going to cook for? What do you mean you're going to go away for 2 days? You're going on a retreat. What's a retreat?
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
That's hard to do. Or you tell your racquetball buddy that you're going on a week long retreat. He'll say, "Are you crazy? What are you doing that for? Some religious stuff?" So our culture punishes us for doing this, and that is certainly an obstacle.
Mm.
And then just the demand of work. I mean, some people work, as you said, to many of your clients, work,
mm-hmm.
work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what gets rewarded monetarily, and it's what gets rewarded even socially. So that's a tremendous challenge.
So thinking about our conversation here, a lot of people talk about life balance, work-life balance. How would you define balance? What does balance look like for you, David?
Balance, to me, looks like, is life the way you want it?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's no magic balance out there that we have to discover.
Mm-hmm.
It's what do you want? What is the right proportion of work to relaxation, to family time, to working out, to all the things that we do in our life? My balance is going to be different from yours. So what I encourage people to do is to really turn in and figure out what is the balance that you need and you like and you want, and work for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact is, I think very often we have to be, you know, life is in some ways very messy. We're not often going to achieve the exact balance that we want. And that's okay. You know, it's so much of life is muddling through anyway. You know, you just do what you need to do. So don't be too hard on yourself in trying to achieve that balance. And the other thing is, you know, for many people who have a busy job and young kids, things will change as they age.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to look forward to that. They have to say, okay, this is a particularly hard time in life.
Yeah.
Because that middle-aged group of people bear the responsibility for the younger generation and often for the older generation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of burdens on their shoulders, and so I think we have to cut them a lot of slack. Help them to stop.
Yeah.
We who are older, encourage them to stop or take over their responsibilities for a while so they can stop.
David, how do you want your readers to feel after they've read this book?
Excited.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
heard and seen. I'd like them to feel heard and seen as to people who are in some kind of pain or challenge, mm-hmm. and anxious to get started.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I would say.
Yeah. I love the background that you've had professionally, and also gleaning more about your personal experiences. I learn so much from everyone that whose paths I cross, whether it be the hospice mm. patients or wonderful guests like mm. you on the radio show. And I have some questions I'd just like to ask you. And sometimes I do this. I don't always do this with guests, but I wanted to do it with you just because you seem like a very interesting person to me. And
oh, thank you.
And I love what you're about, because this is something that I even want more in my life. But the first question is this: what makes you come alive?
I guess I would have to say contributing to life, giving something that is useful for others, that always gets me very involved and mm-hmm. excited. Mm-hmm. Something, you know, I'm basically a helper like you, and I get very gratified if what little bit I do at one moment or one time contributes to the betterment of life. That makes me get up in the morning.
Yeah. Another question I ask, I sometimes ask in workshops I do on the art of living and dying, and that is, were you ever with someone when they took their last breath? And if so, what was that experience like for you the first time?
The answer is yes, I have. And transcending would be my response. It was a peak experience. It was James Hillman is the psychologist. I couldn't remember his name before. James Hillman speaks about the spirituality of the peaks and the spirituality of the veils. The peak experiences are the transcendent ones, the mountaintop, the transfiguration. That's spirit. The soulful ones are in the valley, and they're the messes that the mother deals with family life, of taking care of the kids and cooking dinner and getting her job done. That's also spirituality. There's both the peaks and the veils. Mm. And both of those comprise, not just one, but both of those comprise a spirituality. That's the way I like to think of it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And has there ever been an act of kindness that you'll never forget?
Oh, yes, many. Many, 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 many. I think the one that pops into my mind mm-hmm. is, it's a long story, but when I was leaving ministry and going to graduate school, mm-hmm. there was a mix-up in my credits, and at the very last minute, the school I was admitted to disadmitted me. In other words, says, "Where you're not accepted." And I was all packed and had a trailer in the parking lot ready to go. And this wonderful woman at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, I called up that school to see if they had something that would be equal to a program that I wanted to take. And she just went to bat for me. She heard the anxiety in my voice. She heard my pain. And she went to work, and she was generously looked all over for opportunities to do. I don't want to make the story too long, but she helped me, and she didn't need to. She could have said, you know, I don't know what to tell you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
But she didn't, and so I to this day I think of that. I don't even know her name. Really, I don't.
Yeah. How beautiful.
And I tried to look it up after I got settled in my new life here down here. I tried to look her up, but she had left. And I never traced her, so, but I'll be eternally grateful for that.
Yeah. And if you had a bucket list, what would be one thing on that list?
Oh, boy. Okay. One thing on my bucket list. Okay, I'm pretty old, so I don't have a lot of things in my bucket anymore. I don't have a lot of room in my bucket anymore, but the one thing I want to do is I want to go to Florence.
Oh.
That seems awfully worldly, but that's the thing that comes to my mind.
Yes. Yes.
I want to go to Florence, and I want to just spend time there.
Yeah.
I've read about it so much, and so that's certainly one thing.
I love that. I love
that. I'm sure I'll think of other things, but
yeah.
That doesn't seem right, but
it doesn't seem right.
That's what's honest. Ah,
David Kuntz, it's been such a joy to have you on the program. Again, the book is The Art of Stopping, How to Be Still When You Have to Keep Going. And will you please give your web address, please?
Web address is www.stopping.com.
All right. That's easy to remember. David, it has been a delight and a joy to have you with me today. Thank you so much, and thank you for the gift of this book in this world.
Richard, thank you. It's been a joy to be with you, and I really appreciate it.
A father bought a telescope for his 8-year-old daughter, and on a full moon night, they set up in his backyard. He fixed the lens on the moon so that it took up the entire view, and then his daughter took a look. Astonished at the sight, his daughter said, "Look, Dad! The moon is moving." Her father explained to her that the moon was indeed moving around the earth, just as the earth was moving around the sun. And in a moment of revelation, the wide-eyed girl exclaimed, "Oh my God, we're in space!" It's only when we say enough already to our crazy busy lifestyles that we can awaken and be awestruck by the mystery of life. We can be delighted by fresh revelations about our world and humbled by the fact that we don't know much. A study at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. found that visitors spend an average of 7 seconds viewing any one animal or exhibit. I mean, what's up with that? When was the last time your heart was in awe, in rapture over something beautiful? In the next week, spend at least 5 minutes watching a sunset unfold, or watching the branches sway. Feel your heart soften with the sheer awe of being alive. I'll tell you, a great tool to help you do that is the book we covered today, The Art of Stopping, How to Be Still When You Have to Keep Going. The author is David Kuntz, and again, the website is stopping.com. Well, that's today's program. Thank you so much for joining me. And I also want to thank my engineer, Genesis Brown, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.